they encounter a civilization there with a superior technology. They were described as large Caucasian giants, and they actually say they spent a couple of years there. When they came back, there was a kind of a time difference where they were there actually longer, or it was perceived on the surface that it was longer period than the 2 years that they were there. But they remained there for a while, getting to learn their culture and becoming friends and part of it. This story was never taken as a fictional story. It was written as a pretty much a diary commentary on what Olaf had experienced.
Their capital city was said to be the original Garden of Eden, as taught by the supernatural inhabitants of the city. So even here, we see supernatural entities teaching doctrine to mankind. And this idea of Eden being inside the earth is actually a pretty popular view these days. However, if Eden is in fact in the earth currently, we know biblically that it cannot be inhabited by satanic entities, as it is guarded by cherubims and a flaming sword in order to keep the way of the tree of life, according to Genesis chapter 3, verse 24. Cultures from around the world hold to the belief of this mystical subterranean world of inner earth, believing it to be a place of wonder and tranquility, or the vast opposite. But we have to wonder where these cultures and where these religions have received this secret esoteric knowledge from. Many of these religions involve mystics who will channel spirit guides, opening their bodies up as vessels for demonic possession. In these channeling sessions, the entities will speak mysteries to the person involved, or will take over the body completely to perform what is known as automatic writing. In these events, the writings many of these mystics produce is actually a demonic entity writing out the information through the host. And the information is so mind-blowing, and it draws people into a deep supernatural experience, deceiving them into a mystic lie, all the while blinding them from the truth of Jesus Christ and his plan for the redemption of mankind. And so it's no surprise that people are fascinated with the hollow earth, based on the fact that they want to experience the mystical facade of this spiritual projection. This would explain why countless people and governments alike have sought out on inner earth expeditions in their search for truth. But what are some of the explorations that involve actual evidence? Going back into the 1930s, we find something really bizarre that was published in the LA Times on Monday, January 29th, 1934. The article talks about a subterranean city, or a catacomb city, with lizard people inhabitants and a hidden treasure. Apparently, a geophysical mining engineer had sunk a shaft right beneath Fort Moore Hill, and he discovered an amazing network of subterranean tunnel systems and a lost city with artifacts and evidence of an advanced civilization of lizard people. The article not only breaks down details of this lost city, but also provides a map of the catacomb city as well. And then it connects the lizard people to certain beliefs of the Native American Indians. So Los Angeles, or the City of Angels, specifically has direct ties to ancient serpent-like entities. And this was mainstream public information back in the 30s. And this event in Los Angeles seems to have sparked a movement of treasure hunters and explorers in the region, because actual evidence was presented in the media. Now, we've mentioned a class of beings a few times now, which many refer to as reptilians. Reptilians, serpent people, lizard people, and so on. I used to have a hard time with this until I got more familiar with Genesis chapter 6 and the conspiracy of the fallen angels to create their hybrid offspring. Seraphim angels, also known as burning serpents or fiery serpents, have what we would explain as serpentine qualities. And therefore, when they took wives of the women of earth, their offspring were part serpentine as well. This is just basic science in genetics. Now, Gary Wayne, author of Genesis 6 Conspiracy, has explained how the first generation offspring of seraphs and human women were documented as having snake or viper-like qualities, especially in the face. And their descendants inherited some of these qualities as well. Going into the research of the giants, we see elongated skulls with snake-like jaw structures, which clearly backs this idea up with historical relics. So when the accounts of these lizard or snake people arise, I honestly can't fathom why any explorers would ever want to get that close to them, even in search for treasure, especially going back in California in the 1930s. And if Los Angeles has historic connections to fallen angels and subterranean cities, it makes perfect sense why it's known as the City of Angels. And it makes perfect sense also why the satanic mind control system of Hollywood would be strategically birthed in that same location. But some of the most notable expeditions of the Hollow Earth seem to carry us into the realm of the Nazis in Antarctica. The Nazis were not only keen on obtaining the most powerful occult relics and manuscripts, but they were also emphatic in their search for the inner Earth.
The Nazis did have a vast interest in looking for an opening to a Hollow Earth. It was actually a prophetic part of their whole belief system, that they were destined someday to be reintroduced through an opening of the Hollow Earth to a purebred race that was part of what they were as being the diluted race on the surface. There was a purebred race. This goes back to Helena Blavatsky and her book, Secret Doctrine.
The Nazis knew through all of the arcane, hidden and occultic knowledge that there were underground cities and civilizations still functioning in their power.
The Nazis knew about this stuff, and they did hire, they did mount expeditions to travel the planet looking for artifacts, looking for talismans, looking for the old gods.
In 1938, the Germans began planning an expedition to Antarctica. At the beginning of 1939, a Nazi expedition finally explored what was at the time an uncharted area of the Arctic. By foot and by plane, the Nazis had surveyed a particular area that they were interested in, clearly with a secret agenda. They called it New Schwabenland.
New Schwabenland was in the Antarctic, and it was based on the name of the ship, the New Schwabia, which was the exploration ship. The amount of information in antiquity concerning Antarctica is so voluminous, even back to the 1537 Perry Reese map that showed Antarctica without ice.
Now we're told that Antarctica is one of the harshest climates in the world. It is one of the coldest, it is one of the driest and windiest places on the planet. In the winter months, temperatures can get as low as negative 73 degrees Celsius. This seems to be an odd place for the Nazis or for anyone to be surveying for that matter, until we remember back to the allegations that there is an entrance there at the South Pole, an entrance that leads right into the Hollow Earth. And many people believe that if it weren't for the Nazis' success in their Arctic expedition, then World War II might have never happened.
What's critical is that the Nazis found an entity or a civilization that was ruled by, quote-unquote, the King of the Earth.
Within the same time frame, the Nazis had used political persuasion to explore Tibet and search for Shambhala and its occult enlightenment. We have to remember that the Nazis were on a constant search for all things occult. And with all the legends about Shambhala being the capital of the inner Earth and having a supernatural entity for a king, this was a major part of their occult checklist.
The Nazi expedition to Shambhala originally started in Greenland with the Edda. The Edda were ancient Nordic writings describing a hollow earth. They went there to see if they could find further details or information. This was the top of their agenda. They had to find this opening. From the Edda, they went to an expedition to the Himalayan mountains. The Buddhist monks there, especially the Bonpo sect of Buddhist monks, greeted the Nazis as being a fulfillment of their own prophecies, that there would be a group that would be basically a negative part of a spiritual power, but they were going to be the ones to finish off the fifth Dharma cycle. In other words, there's a cycle of the world coming to a pinnacle point, and then it is destroyed and then rebuilt in a new world. So they saw the Nazis as being the ones that were going to accomplish all of their hopes and expectations. They opened up the cavernous systems within the Himalayas, where they allegedly spoke and had contact with the inner chiefs, what Blavatsky called the secret chiefs, the White Brotherhood. They claimed, yes, they're real. We come in contact with them regularly. So they took them, allowed the Nazis to go in places that they had actually cordoned off from the rest of the world for centuries. They also let them do some earth electromagnetic testing and with their equipment and everything, and it was right after that that they went back. They took actually 200 members of the Bonpo sect and made them SS officers, brought them back to Velasburg Castle under Heinrich Himmler, and then were like a scientific think tank working with the Nazi SS Andernapp to locate where this opening was. It was announced very shortly after that in Der Spiegel, the main news magazine in Germany, that they had discovered the location of the opening to a hollow earth. And the next thing you know, they had the Neuschwabenland expedition to the Queen Maud Land area of the Antarctic, and then the rumors of a base 211, which there's enough of a paper trail that it really happened. It's what drove them. It was a religious belief that drove them to cordon this area off and claim it for their own.
After the war, the mainstream was declaring Hitler's death, but the evidence supports the contrary, that he had actually escaped and made his way to Antarctica, and by some accounts, he had stopped off in Argentina first. But Hitler was not alone. There were nearly 1 million Nazis that made it safely to an inner Earth base in their previously charted territory in Antarctica, according to researchers.
Of course, after World War II, the official narrative that was published by the press was that Adolf Hitler and the ranking members, the senior members of the Nazi party were killed or were captured. But the truth is that some of the most senior members, including Bormann and Hitler, didn't die. They disappeared. And there's reason to believe, including the recently disclosed vault material from the FBI, that Hitler and some of these other ranking Nazi members actually made it to South America, specifically to Argentina. Some accounts even recall him being in Peru. What's interesting about that, what's very provocative about that in my mind, is that that relates to the Chincana, because the Catholic Church, who smuggled a lot of the Nazis out of Europe to South America, knew about the Chincana, and not only knew about it, had access to it for hundreds of years. And there are plenty of legends that connect the underground world beneath the Andes to other parts of the earth. I believe that there is a direct connection between the underworld of the Chincana and what is under Antarctica to the south. Because the Chincana extended from Peru into Bolivia, into Chile and Argentina, probably out under the ocean all the way to whatever is frozen under the ice in Antarctica. So it's very possible that there was an active tunnel system that the Nazis were utilizing that could be accessed in South America through the legendary Chincana.
The Nazis were articulate in records keeping. They kept track of everything. And these people seemed to disappear right off the face of the earth. All throughout the war, before the war, during the war, and even after the war, submarines were going down to the area of Neuschwabenland. They had strange payloads where a crew of that should normally be 8 to 12 people had 50 people in them. So there was a slow process of a migration, I believe, going down to Base 211 in the Antarctic. At the very end of the war, the entire German Reichstag bank disappeared. That doesn't happen by accident, that's by design. General Dönitz said that they, in case the war would take a turn for the worst, they already had secured a fortress within the depths of the ice in the south, alluding probably to the base 211. So I mean, there's so much evidence that there was a migration that was going on during, before, and even after the war.
Now, in this 1 million Nazis that mysteriously disappeared at the closing of the war, we hear allegations that this group was made up of the most educated and powerful thinkers and doers of the Nazi Party. We are talking scientists, doctors, occult magicians, and more. But the evidence of this Arctic Nazi exodus following the war is even more compelling when we factor in Operation High Jump. Roughly a year after World War II ended, the U.S. Navy mounted a massive mission to Antarctica, and seemingly a continuation of the war with the Nazis. Admiral Richard E. Byrd led 4,000 military troops from the United States, Britain, and Australia in this Arctic invasion deemed Operation High Jump. They were led by Admiral Richard E. Byrd's command ship, a large fleet of other warships, as well as crafts, machines, and tools for war. So we're dealing with a major invasion of ships set to war in the Arctic. But it's important to note here that this was not exactly the official story that was being sold to the public at the time. The public was told that this was an exploration mission.
They got Admiral Byrd. He was the only expert in that area during that time that had already been on different expeditions to the Arctic and also his knowledge of the Antarctic. So they sent him down there with 13 ships. Now, if this is a scientific investigation, you look at all the ships, there was not one special built scientific ship, laboratory ship, or anything. There was an aircraft carrier, there were several submarines, there was over 4,000 military men. This was a joint military attack or venture.
In 1947, under Admiral Byrd's direction, there was a flotilla of 13 ships sent to challenge the Nazis and their underground citadel in a place called New Schwabenland.
But here's where the story gets interesting. The USS Pine Island was one of the ships that were part of the fleet. This ship was removed from the Naval Register on an unknown date. The ship's final disposition is still unknown. Now, how does one go about losing a major surface ship, over 640 feet long, almost 70 feet wide, with a displacement of over 15,000 tons? The story, of course, gets stranger. The Pine Island is not the only ship involved in Antarctic research to have disappeared. There were numerous others. So what happened to the ships that went missing during Operation High Jump? These questions seem quickly answered by investigating the personal stories of what took place off the record. There were major battles taking place there, with stories that included UFOs coming up out of the earth and even out of the Arctic waters that were equipped with advanced weaponry that shot energy beams, cutting right through the ships and planes. It was a technology that the armies of the world were not familiar with, and sources claim that this alien technology quickly overpowered the American co-forces that had initiated this war. This was an incredibly unexpected outcome, to say the least.
Admiral Byrd is getting our plane shot down by Nazi flying saucers.
Now, a Chilean newspaper claims that they had ship-to-shore contact with Admiral Byrd, who claimed at the time that in the future they would have to contend with aircraft that could go from pole to pole. My claim and all the evidence, and not so much what is being said, but what wasn't said, was that they had a battle of some sort with the last bastion of Nazis on base 211, and they got their butts kicked.
These are the claims that have surfaced in the aftermath of Operation High Jump, which would sensibly explain why the operation was brought to a short ending.
As soon as they got home, Admiral Byrd was taken to Washington. He was told to be quiet. He was a dutiful soldier and stayed quiet and never said anything more. In that time, he started pushing Washington to start to use the Antarctic to test nuclear bombs. Why? Because he knew there was something there that needed to be nuked. And what better way, a cover story, to do that? Actually, in 1952, 2 months before a bill was finally going to be submitted to Congress to consider this, all of a sudden the famous, and you can see a nice colored picture of it, the famous flyby of a series of UFOs in formation flying over Washington, D.C. As soon as they were seen, the jets were scrambled to confront them, and as soon as they did, the UFOs blinked out. As soon as the jets landed back at the airbase, they're back right where they were before. They reappear. This happened 3 times. Now, what I noticed about it, and flipped me out, because being a history nut, I saw it right away. There's three clusters of UFOs flying over the Capitol. And if you take a real detailed look, you'll see that there's a point man on one level, and then two wingmen staggered. I'm going, oh my God, that's a typical Luftwaffe formation. These saucers are flying in a Luftwaffe formation. This is weird. Our own intelligence fully realized it and fully realized what was going on. Because the next thing you know, the bill is removed from Congress and no more further discussion about it.
The amount of cover-up, murder, Forrestal, James Forrestal, first Secretary of Defense, murdered, thrown out of third Story hospital window in Bethesda, Maryland, and he wanted to go and tell the people. He wanted to tell the people what they had found in the Antarctic.
Shortly after Operation High Jump had failed, Admiral Byrd is documented as taking a North Pole expedition. Now, it's probably a good idea to explain a little bit more about Admiral Byrd before going any further, as this next account is as mind-blowing as they come. Richard Evelyn Byrd was an American naval officer who specialized in feats of great exploration. He was a pioneering American aviator, he was a polar explorer, and he was an organizer of polar logistics. He served as a navigator and expedition leader on aircraft flights, in which he crossed the Atlantic Ocean, a segment of the Arctic Ocean, and even a segment of the Antarctic Plateau. Byrd claimed that his expeditions had been the first to reach the North and South Poles by air, and he was highly accredited and praised for these major accomplishments worldwide. It was in his lifetime that Byrd had amassed 22 citations and special commendations, including the Medal of Honor, which is the highest honor for heroism given by the United States. Byrd was one of only four Americans in history entitled to wear a medal with their own image on it. He was a national hero and explorer, awarded with notoriety even from the Smithsonian. Admiral Byrd was held to a high degree of respect in terms of the world, and he was highly regarded and valued by the U.S. government for a lifetime of accomplishments through expeditions and missions. Finally, he was on the cover of Time magazine, published on Monday, November 8, 1926, as well as two commemorative postage stamps. And his expeditions were publicized greatly in the media of his day.
Our guest tonight found out whether there was any land north of the North American continent. He made that first discovery flight, and I must say that Admiral Byrd, our guest tonight, is not only our greatest living explorer, but he's been an inspiration to countless Americans. Admiral Byrd, you've been to both the North Pole and the South Pole. Is there any unexplored land left on this earth that might appeal to adventurous young Americans?
Yes, there is. And not up around the North Pole, because it's getting crowded up there now, because they find out it's really usable, not only to live in, but militarily.
So what we have here is someone who isn't exactly a Johnny-come-lately. We're not talking about a questionable conspiracy theorist, but rather someone with a lifetime of adventures and documented stories of expeditions that we only hear about or see in the movies. That being stated, a diary has surfaced, claiming to be that of Admiral Byrd, documenting one of the most amazing expeditions to date. We're dealing with a man who was taken into the North Pole by UFOs and was forced to meet with the Inner Earth King, or the Master, if we're going by the diary's own terminology. No one can state it better than the words of the diary itself.
Admiral Richard E. Byrd's diary, February, March, 1947. The land beyond the poles. The exploration flight over the North Pole. The inner earth. My secret diary. I must write this diary in secrecy and obscurity. It concerns my Arctic flight of the 19th day of February in the year of 1947. There comes a time when the rationality of men must fade into insignificance, and one must accept the inevitability of the truth. I am not at liberty to disclose the following documentation at this writing. Perhaps it shall never see the light of public scrutiny. But I must do my duty and record here for all to read one day. In a world of greed and exploitation of certain of mankind, one can no longer suppress that which is truth. Flight log, Base Camp, Arctic. February 19th, 1947. 0600 hours. All preparations are complete for our flight northward, and we are airborne with full fuel tanks at 0610 hours. 0910 hours. Vast ice and snow below. 0915 hours. In the distance is what appears to be mountains. 1000 hours. We are crossing over the small mountain range and still proceeding northward as best as can be ascertained. Beyond the mountain range is what appears to be a valley with a small river or stream running through the center portion. There should be no green valley below. Something is definitely wrong and abnormal here. We should be over ice and snow. To the port side are great forests growing on the mountain slopes. Our navigation instruments are still spinning. The gyroscope is oscillating back and forth. 10.05 hours. I alter altitude to 1,400 feet and execute a sharp left turn to better examine the valley below. It is green with either moss or a type of tight-knit grass. The light here seems different. I cannot see the sun anymore. We make another left turn and we spot what seems to be a large animal of some kind below us. It appears to be an elephant. No, it looks more like a mammoth. This is incredible, yet there it is. Decrease altitude to 1,000 feet and take binoculars to better examine the animal. It is confirmed, it is definitely a mammoth-like animal. Report this to base camp. 10:30 hours. The external temperature indicator reads 74 degrees Fahrenheit. Continuing on our heading now. Navigation instruments seem normal now. I am puzzled over their actions. Attempt to contact base camp. Radio is not functioning. 11:30 hours. Countryside below is more level and normal, if I may use that word. Ahead we spot what seems to be a city. This is impossible. Aircraft seems light and oddly buoyant. The controls refuse to respond. My God! Off our port and starboard wings are a strange type of aircraft. They are closing rapidly alongside. They are disc-shaped and have a radiant quality to them. They're close enough now to see the markings on them. It is a type of swastika. This is fantastic. Where are we? What has happened? I tug at the controls again. They will not respond. We are caught in an invisible vice grip of some type. 11:35 hours. Our radio crackles and a voice comes through in English, with what perhaps is a slight Nordic or Germanic accent. The message is, "Welcome, Admiral, to our domain. We shall land you in exactly 7 minutes. Relax, Admiral. You're in good hands." I note the engines of our plane have stopped running. The aircraft is under some strange control and is now turning itself. The controls are useless. 11:40 hours. Another radio message received. We begin the landing process now, and in moments the plane shudders slightly and begins a descent as though caught in some great unseen elevator. The downward motion is negligible, and we touch down with only a slight jolt. 11:45 hours. I am making a hasty last entry in the flight log. Several men are approaching on foot toward our aircraft. They are tall with blonde hair. In the distance is a large shimmering city, pulsating with rainbow hues of color. I do not know what's going to happen now, but I see no signs of weapons on those approaching. I hear now a voice ordering me by name to open the cargo door. I comply. End log. From this point, I write all the following events here from memory. It defies the imagination. It would seem all but madness if it had not happened. The radio man and I are taken from the aircraft and we are received in a most cordial manner. We were then boarded on a small platform-like conveyance with no wheels. It moves us toward the glowing city with great swiftness. As we approach, the city seems to be made of a crystal material. Soon, we arrive at a large building that is a type I have never seen before. It appears to be right out of the design board of Frank Lloyd Wright, or perhaps more correctly, out of a Buck Rogers setting. We are given some type of warm beverage which tasted like nothing I have ever savored before. It is delicious. After about 10 minutes, two of our wondrous appearing hosts come to our quarters and announce that I am to accompany them. I have no choice but to comply. I leave my radio man behind, and we walk a short distance and enter into what seems to be an elevator. We descend downward for some moments, and the machine stops, and the door lifts silently upward. We then proceed down a long hallway that is lit by rose-colored light that seems to be emanating from the very walls themselves. One of the beings motions for us to stop before a great door. Over the door is an inscription that I cannot read. The great door slides noiselessly open and I am beckoned to enter. One of my hosts speaks. "Have no fear, Admiral. You are to have an audience with the Master." I step inside and my eyes adjust to the beautiful coloration that seems to be filling the room completely. Then I begin to see my surroundings. What greeted my eyes is the most beautiful sight of my entire existence. It is, in fact, too beautiful and wondrous to describe. It is exquisite and delicate. I do not think there exists a human term that can describe it in any detail with justice. My thoughts are interrupted in a cordial manner by a warm, rich voice of melodious quality. I bid you welcome to our domain, Admiral. I see a man with delicate features and with the etching of years upon his face. He is seated at a long table. He motions me to sit down in one of the chairs. After I am seated, he places his fingertips together and smiles. He speaks softly again and conveys the following. We have let you enter here because you are of noble character and well known on the surface world. Surface world, I half gasp under my breath. Yes, the master replies with a smile. You are in the domain of the Ariani, the inner world of the Earth. We shall not long delay your mission, and you will be safely escorted back to the surface and for a distance beyond. But now, Admiral, I shall tell you why you have been summoned here. Our interest rightly begins just after your race exploded the first atomic bombs over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan. It was at that alarming time we sent our flying machines, the Flugarads, to your surface world to investigate what your race had done. That is, of course, past history now, my dear Admiral, but I must continue on. You see, we have never interfered before in your race's wars and barbarity, but now we must, for you have learned to tamper with a certain power that is not for man, namely, that of atomic energy. Our emissaries have already delivered messages to the powers of your world, and yet they do not heed. Now you have been chosen to be witness here that our world does exist. You see, our culture and science is many thousands of years beyond your race, Admiral. I interrupted, but what does this have to do with me, sir? The Master's eyes seemed to penetrate deeply into my mind, and after studying me for a few moments, he replied, "Your race has now reached the point of no return, for there are those among you who would destroy your very world rather than relinquish their power as they know it." I nodded, and the Master continued, "In 1945 and afterward, we tried to contact your race, but our efforts were met with hostility. Our Flugarads were fired upon, yes, even pursued with malice and animosity by your fighter planes. So, now I say to you, my son, there is a great storm gathering in your world, a black fury that will not spend itself for many years. There will be no answer in your arms. There will be no safety in your science. It may rage on until every flower of your culture is trampled, and all human things are leveled in vast chaos. Your recent war was only a prelude of what is yet to come for your race. We here see it more clearly with each hour. Do you say I'm mistaken?" "No," I answer. "It happened once before. The Dark Ages came and they lasted for more than 500 years. "Yes, my son," replied the Master. "The Dark Ages that will come now for your race will cover the Earth like a pall. But I believe that some of your race will live through the storm. Beyond that, I cannot say. We see at a great distance a new world stirring from the ruins of your race, seeking its lost and legendary treasures. And they will be here, my son, safe in our keeping. When that time arrives, we shall come forward again to help revive your culture and your race. Perhaps by then, you will have learned the futility of war and its strife. And after that time, certain of your culture and science will be returned for your race to begin anew. You, my son, are to return to the surface world with this message." With these closing words, our meeting seemed at an end. I stood for a moment as in a dream, but yet I knew this was reality, and for some strange reason I bowed slightly, either out of respect or humility. I do not know which. Suddenly I was again aware that the two beautiful hosts who had brought me here were again at my side. "This way, Admiral," motioned one. I turned once more before leaving and looked back toward the Master. A gentle smile was etched on his delicate and ancient face. "Farewell, my son," he spoke. Then he gestured with a lovely, slender hand motion of peace, and our meeting was truly ended.